of sheet metal and screening in the air, giving you a whole lot of wind load and ice load and a whole lot of grief, and you may not be getting anywhere near the benefit once you understand area relationships. If you know that your two dipoles, your two whip antennas, one behind the other, is going to give you, let me pick a number, 4 decibels of gain. Maybe that's the real number. That's a 2-to-1 relationship of area. You've doubled the area, the capture area of the antenna by putting up that second whip and feeding it correctly. If you know that the two whips, and there's ways you can research this, you can find out exactly what the new gain is going to be. You can calculate what the new area is going to be. And you may be surprised to find that that real area of the second whip is going to be larger than that parabolic surface you were about to construct. You've now got a way of boiling it down to a formula, and you decide, should you go forward or do something different? Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Very good, Dick. I think you saved this gentleman a lot of time, and I hope he's listening. If I can, I'm going to try to email him to listen to the tech net. If he didn't copy it tonight, maybe go on Perry's site and pick this up. Okay, that's about it from the mailbag. So let's go over to Paul and see what's happening in the world of space. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, Mike Perry's website, KC2NJI, is at amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and in theory, the last 7.5 years of TechNet, 4 hours per Sunday night, you can play it all back and listen to it another time. We're going to go to the mailbag, and then I'm going to give you a few more words on waveguide, if you can tolerate it. It's a real mystery the way waveguide behaves. Hey, Paul, what is NASA doing this week? WS2N, K2RIW, you got a call.
You know, Dick, it seems that there's never enough information on antennas or waveguides, so I think that's a great subject. Back to you.
You've got a call.
Okay, very good, Dick. WS2N. Yeah, I didn't have much tonight, but I just wanted to talk a couple of minutes on the Rosetta spacecraft. That's the one that's going to that comet 67P, and it's got a long name. Two people that discovered it. But this thing is going to be landing a craft on it in November. In other words, it's a spacecraft, and it has a, it'll be like the mothership, and it'll send a Philippe lander down, and it will land on this comet, and it'll stay on that comet all the way around the sun until it pops out on the other side. This is all going to take a couple of years. It'll stay, you know, stay with the comet that whole time. So it was launched like, I don't know, 10 years ago. And Rosetta is a big spacecraft. I mean, it's got solar panels that are about 60 feet long each. So it's getting to a critical point now where they're going to do an engine burn. And this engine burn, I was reading it, and they said 8 hours. And I said, that can't be right. Let me check on this. So sure enough, it's that's what they're going to do. It's, you know, hydrazine type of fuel on board with an oxidizer and thousands of pounds of fuel. And it's designed to have these thrusters. They have 24 thrusters all over the spacecraft, 24 of them. And they all operate with a 10 Newton force. I looked that up. That's a little over 2 pounds of force on each thruster. And I think starting tomorrow, they're going to ignite the thrusters. And it's going to be operating for 8 hours, slow itself down. Right now, it's coming up to the comet very quickly, coming up behind. And they want to slow that rate down. And they're going to do this 3 times. A couple of weeks from now and a couple of weeks after that until they slow down to the point where they're closing in on the comet at around 1 meter per second. And it'll sit like that for a long period of time. Eventually they'll go into orbit around the comet and they have a little lander, and that will separate from the craft in November and go down and land on the comet. It's by the European Space Agency, and NASA is involved. We have a lot of technical instruments on board. You know, there's probably about 10 different instruments on the Rosetta spacecraft, and another, I think, 8 on the lander. So, you know, after 10 years of being launched from French Guiana on an Ariane 5 rocket, that's a heavy lift rocket from the European Space Agency, it's finally getting into position. It woke up a couple of months ago, back I think in January. It was asleep for 3 years, so they were happy that that all worked out. And I'll be following this mission pretty closely in the next year or two. I think after it lands, it goes behind the sun. The mission's going to continue on as the comet goes further out away from the sun. So probably the next year or two, Rosetta will be sending information back regarding this whole thing. You know, I got information on the spacecraft if you want. You know, how big it is, how many watts and all that. So I'll turn it back to you, Dick. Only one other main topic. You've got a launch on the 28th of 3 more people going up to the space station from Kazakhstan, from Baikonur. They'll be launched. Take them 6 hours. I think around 6 hours to get to the space station once they do that, after launch. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
You said you did have another subject you wanted to go to. Go right ahead, Paul.
That's just the launch of the three people, one from the European Space Agency, another guy from NASA, and then one Russian. And they'll be going up to the space station to join the other three that are up there. Remember, a week or two ago, the other... they had three come back. Expedition 4041. They always have two numbers. You know, they go up because they start off as, you know, one expedition number, and then as the other three leave, these people will be on board. One guy will eventually take over, becoming the commander, and then it'll switch over to expedition. Will come up. So that's the way it goes, rotation. But, again, the main topic is this Rosetta spacecraft with the it's got solar arrays, I think something like 800 watts of power from a couple of AU out, and when it's further out, like 5 or 6 AU, it goes down to but the spacecraft itself weighs like 660 kilograms, so it's almost 1,500 pounds, not the spacecraft, but the propellant. You know, they have this hydrazine fuel, probably similar to what the shuttle used to use, you know, for their thrusters. And then a couple of thousand pounds of this oxidizer, the nitrogen tetroxide, again, a common oxidizer. And over half the weight of the spacecraft is fuel, and that's the way it is on most of these spacecraft. When they go up, everything's fuel. So I'd like to see this whole thing come off. And, you know, but it is a big, very big spacecraft. It's the first one to ever get out near Jupiter. Took a lot of pictures when it was out there. That's operated without the RTG, the radioisotope thermal electric generator. It had these solar panels roughly 120 feet end-to-end, producing, like I said, 850 watts at the 3 AU period, AU astronomical unit area, and about 400, you know, roughly half that when it was at its furthest point. At 5 AU. So, got these Nikon batteries on there. And they got four of them, and each one is 10 amp hours, so it's like 40 amp hour batteries. I carry power packs around in my car, and I know how many amp hours they are. I can relate to that. How big these batteries must be that are inside the spacecraft. Back to you, Dick, for any comments or anything. This is WS2N, space portion of the TechNet.
Question? Person who said question, please give us your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your question. K2LIW.
Thank you, Dick. This is Mike, Kilo 1, Mike Juliet Mike. I was wondering a couple of things. How does the spaceship attach itself to the comet to stay there? Is there enough gravity there to hold it in place? And also, what is the relationship in the mass between the comet and the spaceship? And is the spaceship going to have an effect on the orbit of the comet? Back over to you, Dick. K1MJM, clear.
Very fine, Mike. And Bob, you're going to answer that question. And then when you're finished, I'm going to ask Mike a question. Mike is the guy, by the way, who set up this beautiful website called LimeRockTechNet.com. Go ahead, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, the Philip lander will get down just close to the surface, and then it's going to attach itself, some kind of a charge or something. They're going to attach itself to the comet, very low gravity. So I'm hoping that works. So, again, it's eight or six. I'm still looking at how many different experiments are on the lander itself, and they'll transmit up to the Rosetta mothership, and then that of course will transmit back to Earth, and they're gonna put this thing in orbit around the comet. I guess they said the way they're going to leave that spacecraft, it'll be all the instruments on the orbiter will be pointing toward the comet, and yet the antenna will be pointing back to Earth. And it was a tough read on one website it was on, but they made it seem like it's going to be like that when it's in orbit around the comet, right? What they meant is as it's following. I can see them doing that. It'll be following that comet the whole way. So I just want to find out the name of that lander itself. Philippe, I forgot how to pronounce it, but it's put in the Rosetta spacecraft. Information on that, you can find out everything about this thing. I forget how to spell this, Philippe. It's like PH.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's the deal with the lander. Some kind of charge is going to attach itself. Here it is. PHILAE. That's the name of the lander. Named after some island in the Nile River. Back to you, Dick.
Any further questions or comments there, Mike? K1MJM, K2LAW.
No, I'm all set. Back over to you, Dick. K1MJM.
Yeah, I just did an archaeological dig with my pile of books, and I found the QST article. It's sad that I don't remember the reference of my own article. UHF Antenna Ratiometry is the name of the article, and I keep forgetting the date. It is the February issue 1976, QST. February 76 has this article about setting up a ratiometry antenna range, and I think I told you that one of the world's best antenna ranges is the one at the Rome Air Development Center, and I did some work there around 1989, 1990, and they are using a ratiometry antenna range, and the engineers who work there now, I asked them, who set up the ratiometry antenna range, and the guy who had set it up had retired, and they didn't know where he got the idea from. There's a chance he got the idea from QST magazine. So my question to you, Mike, is that a number of my articles and submissions to the Microwave Reflector, and you have on your website, and I don't know whether or not you do have yet the February 1976 issue of QST, which you can get it. Let me drop it. If you don't have it, you can always get it from the QST or ARRL archives. Unfortunately, the archives, when you get an issue there, it's a little bit low in resolution. The pictures are more than high enough in resolution you can understand what's going on, but they're not quite as pretty. So I wonder if that article is on your website already, Mike. K1MJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is K1MJM. Dick, it's not on my website. You did send it to me when I asked about a radio telescope a couple months ago, so I do have a copy of it. I also have a copy of an article called RF by Zach Lau, W1BT. I could put both of those on my website if you would like. K1MJM, back over to you.
Send the mic from me to Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it over to you in a minute, Paul. I think I gave you an article by Zach Lau where he made a six-element equivalent. I think it was six elements, a 432 Yagi, insulated Yagi. I claim to be the inventor of the insulated Yagi, which gives you the advantage that the elements not going through the boom, breaking contact, building up aluminum oxide, detuning themselves. So if you insulate the elements with shoulder bushings, the problem goes away. And so the 19-element RIW-19 Yagi is an insulated Yagi. And Zach Lau built a six-element, I think it was a six-element or a four-element equivalent of it, and it appeared in the microwave experimenters, QTC, is it? No. All of a sudden I forgot the name of the journal that is the experimenters exchange of ARRL. And the main reason I was indicating that to you is it shows the method of construction, of properly feeding the driven element in a nice, sexy, mechanical way, and the insulating the element and so on. So the construction of an insulated Yagi is there. The 19-element insulated Yagi never appeared as an article because my good friend George, W2KRM, was manufacturing them. So it was a commercial product at the time. That's the reason I didn't write an article on it. Back to you for any comments on this one, Mike. And then you send it over to Paul. K1MJM, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
It's 3 hours in for the comments.
Roger that, Dick. They're both excellent articles. Magazine is QEX Magazine. And like I said, I have both of those articles, and I will put both of those on my website. So they'll be on there tonight. I'll make sure I can get to that tonight. K1MJM, over to Paul, and then over to the other breaking station. K1MJM, clear.
Okay, Mike, very good. This is Paul WS2N. I know we went over this a couple of times, but I didn't have a clue on how to enter articles into that website. I know Dick has managed to do it successfully. I wonder if maybe you could let me know how to do it. I'm probably not now over the air, but you know, maybe you could email me again at that same email. If that's okay, Mike. Let's see what I have to do. Codes or whatever you got to do. And that's spacenetreport@gmail.com. And anybody else who wants to ask questions, of course, that's my email for SpaceNet. I wonder if you're, you understand my question, Mike. K1MJMWS1.
I'm going to guess that the way it's done is you take the article, and if it passes muster, if it meets Mike's standards, then you send it to Mike, and if it meets the standards, it appears on the website. Isn't that the process, Mike? You can tell us on the how you do it. K1MJM, K2LIW.
Roger, I think that's the KISS method, the keep it simple method. Just send it to me, and I'll put it on there. K1MJM, back over to you.
Slacko Oscar, Dick.
Yeah, you're on the list, Rich, don't worry. N2EO, K2LIW, go ahead.
Right, just email it to you, correct?
Yeah, just email it to Mike, and it automatically appears on the website. Isn't that true, Mike?
Roger that, yep. Okay, how about pictures? In other words, I just send you, like, an email that's an attachment That just goes with it? Is that what you do?
That's it. There was a guy who sent him a picture of this crazy person hanging off the side of a tower. And it appeared on Mike's website. Do you know who that guy is, Mike?
Roger, I've seen his picture and I've heard him around. Yep.
A little bit crazy. Okay. N2EL, K2RW. What's your question, Rich?
Okay, not a question, Dick. I just wanted to attest to the fact years ago when I used the RIW-19 on 432, it worked extremely well. It looked like it had a very good pattern. I know you had that tandem reflector. It looked very, very good. And, you know, those clips that hold the shoulder bushings in are used by M-squared. I don't remember now if M-squared, I think they're using the shoulder bushings too. I know they solved the problem. There was a problem on the RIW-19 where they were a little too tight. They would break. But they eventually solved that. Get back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that original Yagi, the 19-element Yagi, the fair copy, as it's called, the prime element, the one that was, I think I put 150 hours in my backyard of tuning that damn thing, developed some real good, strong leg muscles running up and down the ladder tuning that. That antenna, the original antenna, each of the elements was mounted in a small plastic block. The plastic blocks sat on top of the boom by way of tie wraps. So I knew I was going to be insulating the elements from the boom, and the way I did it at first is plastic box with the elements sitting on top. The advantage of that is that I could easily slide the element forward and back along the boom because I wasn't drilling holes in the boom. I could easily rotate an element 90 degrees, make it instead of horizontal and vertical, to take the element out of the array to find out how hard that particular element is working. I could rotate an element 90 degrees so that instead of horizontal, it's vertical. It's no longer there electronically. And when you do that with the reflector, you only lose a few tenths of a dB of gain. That's how I discovered that. So it's a very convenient tuning process. Along came George Flanagan, W2KRM, a real genius of a mechanical engineer with a lot of electronic smarts. And he invented the technique of those shoulder bushings and those retainers that slide along the elements to hold them in place. So he invented that technique. He refined the method of construction of the key match and so on. So that beautiful mechanical construction was all done by W2KRM. And when he was manufacturing antennas way back in the dark ages of the late 80s, of late 70s and early 80s, let me drop. He called himself RIW Products. That was the name of his company. And he was filling up his cellar with aluminum chips as he was drilling all those holes and all those booms to manufacture those Yagi kits. He was selling those Yagis in kit form. So the boom comes apart in three pieces. They telescope together. The elements can all be folded flat inside of a piece of mailing tubing, so to speak. And I don't remember what the price was that he was selling those, but he sold quite a few thousand of them. So it was a win-win situation, if you know what I mean. An awful lot of people had the original W2KRM manufactured Yagi kit for the RIW-19 Yagis. There are a fair number of antenna ranges where people are setting up a range to measure the gain of 432 or 449 megacycle Yagis. Let me drop. Where they need a standard gain antenna, and they use the RIW-19 as a standard. A fair number of antenna ranges do that. So the criteria you want for an antenna is that you want it to, for a standard for an antenna range, is that you want it to have an agreed upon amount of gain that you can compare everything to, that everyone agrees to, and you want it to have a fairly clean pattern so that it is only lighting up the antenna on the test on the antenna range and not just sending a lot of signals off to the side and the back and lighting up all the other hardware and trees and buildings and everything else that's around. So that antenna fulfills that requirement. So a long Yagi antenna on VHF frequencies on an outdoor antenna range
make a very good reference antenna. And a fair number of the VHF, UHF amateur radio clubs do it that way. When it comes to frequencies like 5 and 10 gigahertz, the standard gain antenna is a horn. That's the industry standard. Because the Yagi approach does a beautiful job from HF frequencies all the way up to, let me pick a number, a couple of gigahertz, if you're willing to build it as a loop Yagi. Let me drop it. And the reason why you build a 1 gig, 2 gig, 4 gig Yagi antenna as a loop Yagi is because of the water droplet problem. When your Yagi is a loop Yagi, the water droplets will slide down the loop toward the center where the water droplets don't do any damage, so to speak. If you build Yagi elements on, say, 2300 megacycles, where the elements are only going to be a couple of inches long, when the dew forms early in the morning and you get droplets of water on the end of those elements, the capacitance added by the end of the elements of the droplets of water will make the Yagi fire in the wrong direction. So droplets of water on the very high frequency Yagis are troublesome unless you build them in a loop Yagi manner. There are people who build loop Yagis on those frequencies because they think it has more gain. I'm reasonably sure that that is not true. The real advantage is rain vulnerability, if you know what I mean. It turns out that what a Yagi consists of is a slow wave structure with a velocity profile. I told you that already. Each of the individual elements, in order to be a director or reflector, have to have a particular resonant frequency. And whether that element is built in a manner that is square, round, triangular, rectangular, as long as it has the right resonant frequency and is located in the right position along the boom, all your Yagi phenomena takes place. So you could, if you want to, make all of the elements out of coat hanger wire and bend them in such a way that they look like the first initial of your name. And as long as it has the right horizontal resonant frequency, the Yagi will perform. The best example of that, let me drop, is the so-called cigar antenna. WA5EJB made a Yagi for 915 megacycles using disk memory, CD-ROM disks. They're a conductive bound object. He stacked them on a boom. With a nibbling tool, he made the diameter a little bit different. So you got a whole bunch of these great big flat washers along the boom. To anybody who has any reasonable common sense, you can say to yourself, hey, they're all going to be shadowing each other. That signal's not going to flow down there. Oh boy, that signal doesn't know any better. It sees those individual objects as having a particular resonant frequency. If the resonant frequency is high enough that they are a director, whether they are a disc of metal or a dipole-like structure, doesn't matter. WA5EJB built this disc Yagi antenna. It's called the Simone antenna. Some people call it a cigar antenna. When he appeared on the antenna range with that thing at an antenna measuring contest, various people started laughing at him, saying, boy, all those elements are going to be shadowing each other. That signal's not going to go down. It's not going to have any gain. And boy, did they have to eat crow. Anybody got any comments or questions on all of the above? KTRIW listening. I use that as an example that you can make each of the elements, bend up pieces of wire so that it looks like the initials of your name or any other shape you like. As long as it has the right resonant frequency, the Yagi phenomena will occur. Yagis are a weird mixture of things that are sensitive and insensitive. If you're building a typical Yagi out of round elements, like an RIW-19, the diameter of the element is quite critical. If you decide that instead of building them out of a 3/16 diameter aluminum rod, you decide to build them at a 1/4 inch diameter aluminum rod, you've got a brand new design. You've got to readjust the length. By the way, make it a little bit shorter. The chamfering of the, to get rid of the sharp edges at the end of each element, the way you cut them, by rounding off the elements a little bit, that slightly detunes it. So the length of the element is quite critical. The diameter of the element is quite critical. The position of the element along the boom is not critical. You can take any one, two, or three of those elements and shove them forward an inch or shove them back an inch, and as long as it's not an accumulative error, very little gain change takes place. You can change the diameter of the element in the case of an insulated Yagi, and very little happens. So the diameter of the boom doesn't matter. The diameter of the element matters a lot. The length of the element matters a lot. The position of the element is somewhat insensitive as long as it's not an accumulative error. If you take every one of those spacings and increase them by an inch, you've got a brand new Yagi. But if a couple of them are misplaced by an inch or so, not much happens. The individual elements, you'd like to think for a horizontally polarized Yagi, they've all got to be perfectly parallel to the ground. Absolutely not true. You could stagger them back and forth so that some of them are tilted to 20 degrees up, 15 degrees down, and you stagger them all kinds of crazy ways like that. Almost nothing will change when you did that. That's not one of the sensitive items.
Repeater, timeout.
So I said, I'm just saying, a Yagi is a weird mixture of things that are sensitive and not sensitive. Tilt of the elements, rotating them around the boom, so to speak, doesn't count very much. If the element is rotated in azimuth, not very much happens. So positions are not too sensitive. Rotation, orientation of the element is not too sensitive. Diameter and length is sensitive. And chamfering, rounding off the end of the element is sensitive. Until you actually build one on a high resolution ratiometry antenna range, you wouldn't know that. The person who builds the Yagi for the first time thinks he's got to get all the elements to the nearest a thousandth of an inch. Nowhere near that accuracy is required. At 432, if you build all the elements to the nearest 16th of an inch, you're pretty close. Diameter, quite critical. And in the case of the Cushcraft Yagis, where each of the elements are not 3/16 of an inch diameter, they're an 1/8 of an inch in diameter. My goodness, does that make a difference, particularly on 2 meters. That makes the element very flimsy. You walk that Yagi up the tower when it's strapped to your back, and as it touches various things, those elements get bent. A bird sitting on the elements will bend them. And when the elements are that small in diameter, they're very ice and snow and rain sensitive. When you go from 1/8 inch diameter to 3/16 of an inch diameter, that extra 1/16 of an inch, all of a sudden, a lot of those sensitivities and weaknesses of size disappear. If you make the Yagi fat enough, if you make the elements fat enough, that's one of the portions of that patent of mine that I think is a pretty valuable one. When you make the element super fat because you're doing it out of sheet metal, and radio-wise, the element looks fat to that radio wave if it has width, whether or not it...
Repeater, timeout.
At 915 megacycles, you can easily build a Yagi out of sheet metal, where the elements and the boom are all one piece of sheet metal, where you just cut it out with scissors the right way, so to speak. And when you make the elements wide out of sheet metal, the fact that they are thin doesn't matter. They act as if they were round. The radio wave can't tell the difference. So the diameter of the element isn't critical in the area of making a wide element out of sheet metal that is thin. And if now in that sheet metal thin Yagi, the first time you build it, you're building it out of a sheet metal that is a 15 thousandth of an inch thick, and then you build it out of metal that's a 28 thousandth of an inch thick, nothing will change. So thickness doesn't matter, width matters, diameter matters, length matters, position doesn't matter, tilt and rotation doesn't matter, almost. Ain't that a crazy mixture? Yeah, these are great things. And I've spent the last 10 years of my life, day in and day out, in front of a high-resolution Rode & Schwarz vector network analyzer, tuning antennas at 915 megacycle, because that particular client needed a whole lot of different 915 megacycle antennas to operate their... RFID readers, or RFID interrogators, radio frequency identification tag reader. And what makes that antenna so critical is that an RFID reader is a CW radar. The tag only talks to you when it's receiving a signal. So you're trying to listen to the signal coming from the radio identification tag while you're transmitting a signal to it. So the antenna that's doing the receiving, the antenna that's doing the transmitting, in that interrogator that's in your hand, is the exact same antenna. It is one antenna. That's why I'm calling it a CW radar. The signal you're sending out is 1 watt in power. The signal you're getting back is minus 75, minus 80 dBm. 1 watt is plus 30. What's coming back is minus 80. That's 110 decibels of power spread between the signal you're transmitting and the signal you're receiving. When you do that, you better have an antenna that has a 1.05 standing wave ratio. Otherwise, the reflected signal from your own antenna, because of standing wave ratio, the signal that reflects from your own antenna when you're transmitting will come back and jam your own receiver. So therefore, you need antennas with extremely low standing wave ratio. Reflection coefficient of minus 25 and minus 30 dB if you can get it. Minus 30 dB, by the way, is something like a 1.02 standing wave ratio. The company that needed that antenna wrote down those specifications, went out to a whole bunch of antenna companies, and said, please give us a quote for you to build this antenna for us. I don't know exactly how many. I'm guessing there was a 5 or 10 companies.
Repeater, timeout.
I don't know the exact number of antenna companies they went to. It was something like 5 or 10 companies. Every single one of them no-bid the job. Most of them didn't even comment as to why. They thought the specification was crazy. You ask for a production level antenna with three elements that's physically strong, physically attractive looking so that it passes the muster of the industrial design department so that the customer will be pleased to look at the darn thing. You ask for an antenna that meets all those requirements, and the customer, the vendor of those antennas, thinks you're crazy. They ask you, what planet are you on? Nobody has ever specified antennas like that with that higher performance. They all no bid. I came along and built those antennas for them. There was one manufacturer. Ain't that crazy? So just because everybody is positive, you can't. Each one of those companies, when we finally went to them and said, why did you no bid? And they said, anything better than a 1.5 standing wave ratio, we're not going to get any yield. You know, only 1% of the antennas are going to meet the requirement. We can't go into a production like that and make a profit. So they all don't bid the job. Those are the ones that you forced to give an answer. Most of them even wouldn't even give an answer because they thought the specification was somebody that's crazy. That's what you really need to do to get high performance out of a RFID reader. So once you understand the principle of operation, there's a lot of things you can do with a Yagi, even though the Yagi's been around for 75 years. Can you reinvent a Yagi after 75 years? The answer is absolutely yes. K2RIW. Anybody else with any further questions or comments? Give me a call. That is right now. Good evening, and 2ABG. Hey, Dave. Give us a few words on that beautiful air show. I was too busy. I couldn't get a chance to go. I know I should have gone over to Republic Airport to see what was going on there, and then go over to Jones Beach. You were there. Tell us what it's like, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW. Or anything else you want to discuss?
Well, N2APG, Dave and Matt Stigler, good evening to everybody. If you've never seen the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds fly in person, that's a must-see. The guys are absolutely fantastic. And I have a question. Because today, while I was watching them, I was also listening to them on three frequencies that are publicized on the internet. And I'm kind of confused a little bit because, you know, you got six planes flying around in all different formations and things like that. And I'm listening to them talk on three different frequencies. And I'm trying to figure out exactly what's going on, who's listening to what frequency and who's talking on what frequency, because, you know, I'm wondering, are they listening to all three frequencies at once, or, you know, are maybe the two solo planes talking on one channel and the other four planes are talking on another channel? So if anybody knows exactly what's going on with their communications while they're flying. I would be interested in that. And also, the second question is, does anybody know how powerful their transmitters are? Because from my observations, I would think their signals were extremely weak. Dick, go ahead.
Were you using a Bofang receiver to receive those frequencies? My first question, Dave. Also, when you tune to the three different frequencies, did each of the three frequencies seem to be equal amount of traffic on them? And when you listen to that traffic, did the traffic sound like frequency number one was only used by aircraft number one, if you know what I mean? So tell us the characteristics of signal strength. What were you using? And by the way, some of the Bofang receivers have a mysterious failure within the rubber duck antenna that I've been discovering. Over to you, Dave, KQLIW.
Hi, Dick. Well, I was using a wideband handheld scanner. As far as I know, they do transmit in the AM mode, so perhaps that has an influence in the, you know, the way it sounds, the way you perceive the signal strength. But, you know, again, it sounded to me as if the signals were relatively weak, considering the planes were, you know, line of sight within a mile or 2 miles or 3 miles of my location. I would think the signal would be a lot stronger, and it seemed to be, you know, just a relatively weak signal. As far as the traffic goes, difficult to tell who exactly is, you know, transmitting. There were times when they did a quick roll call, for instance, like the lead pilot would announce, okay, we're going to do, you know, a flat barrel roll now coming up, and then all the other five planes would quickly, you know, Roger, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, in very quick succession, they would all give a quick key of the mic and you know, a little quip as if to say, we're on your page, you know, we copy that. So, but other than that, it's hard to tell. Like I said, out of the three frequencies, one was used predominantly. One frequency was a lot busier than the other two. However, the other two also had chatter on it at different times. So I figured maybe somebody out there would know exactly what they're, you know, what they're up to.
U.S. to one.
Paul recognized, and I'm going to add a comment right now, and that is, I own two Bofangs. My son owns two. Had we joined you, Dave, each one of us could tune one of our Bofangs to one of those frequencies, so we're listening to all of them simultaneously. That would be a lot of fun to really figure out what's going on. And I am guessing that each one of those aircraft have three separate simultaneous receivers. It's probably one object behind an instrument panel. It's a triple receiver, and the audios on proper selection, all three receivers mix the audio together into the earphone, so to speak, is my guess. Let's see what Paul's going to say. WS2N, K2RAW.
I don't know why they have the three frequencies, but notice, you mentioned AM. Anything like that would... they would always do it with AM. They use FM due to the capture effect. One guy is talking and he's giving instructions, and if somebody else sees something that is amiss, they, you know, with FM you can't, you know, you're not going to be, you know, be able to overcome that signal. But with AM, you get like multiple, you know, you can get two or three stations at the same time if they're talking and one guy's yelling, you know, going the wrong way, you know. Yeah, he's going to hear it. That's about all I know about that. Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, the quick question I got for you, Dave, I hope you were using an AM receiver. If you were listening to an AM broadcast on an FM receiver, that would make it sound like it's a very weak audio signal. I'm pretty sure you were using an AM receiver. The FAA, either for traditional reasons or good scientific reasons, always uses aircraft communication with amplitude modulation. And just like, let me drop. Just like Paul said, with amplitude modulation, Two guys can talk at once, and you stand a chance of hearing both of them. With FM and that capture effect, one of those guys would most of the time get wiped out. Single sideband is even better on that. You could have four conversations on the exact same frequency on single sideband. You would hear no beat note between them if they're all on the right same frequency, and you'd hear each of the four individual audios as if all the others were not there, if you know what I mean. So, was it an AM receiver? And what was your antenna like? Because they probably are transmitting on a crazy frequency like 370 megahertz, was your antenna really tuned to that frequency, Dave? N2APG, KQLAW in the TechNet. N2APG. I had a fairly long, approximately 18-inch rubber duck, wideband receiving type antenna. The frequencies that they were using, real quick, 237 megahertz, 275 megahertz, and 284 megahertz. So that's military air in the AM mode. Yes, the receiver was an AM receiver on the AM mode. I'll do some more investigating and stuff. Most of the time when I go down to the air show, I'm so excited about going down there to see him that I forget to bring my scanner. Well, if I bring my scanner, I haven't programmed the frequencies in, so I don't have that ready. So this weekend, I actually planned ahead and researched the frequencies, pre-programmed them into the scanner, and then remembered to bring the scanner to the show as well. So not only was I watching them, but I was listening to them at the same time simultaneously. And it was quite interesting. And an interesting little something that I learned, Dick, let me drop it.
By the way, did you program your scanner to go to 237, 275, and 284 sequentially and stop whenever it heard a carrier? Is that what you were doing, Dave?
Yeah, pretty much. I had copied about a list of 10 frequencies that appeared to be possibilities. I wasn't sure where they were going to show up. There were 10 frequencies listed on the internet that, you know, they had been using. So out of those 10 frequencies, three of them, you know, popped up, and they were on those three frequencies, which other people had heard them prior to, you know, as well last year, the year before. So these are frequencies that everybody knows that, you know, they're on. And as far as the Baofengs wouldn't go there. They don't cover 237, 275, you know. They don't have that range. But an interesting thing, they don't wear G-suits when they're doing the shows. Do you know why, Dick?
As the G-suit inflates, it would move your hand, and therefore your precision movement of your hand on that control stick might cause two aircraft in a tight formation to touch each other. Is that a guess, Dave?
Well, as you once said, give that man a cigar. Exactly correct. When they're in combat situation, they wear the G-suit, and they don't have to worry because they're not flying in such tight formation. They have plenty of room. But when they're doing these precise demonstrations where you have a plane that's maybe 18, 20 inches away from you, when that G-suit inflates, it's going to move your hand, your arm a little bit, and that's enough to change the, you know, the location of the plane. They can't have that. So they don't wear the G-suit just for that reason.
Now, when it comes to precision movement of a hand, and you're watching it with a camera, if you had a chance today to watch any of the Indy 500 on ABC television, where they've got on almost every one of those cars, they've got a couple of cameras that can either aim forward, aft, or look directly at the pilot, at the driver. And when you see that driver moving his hand in a very precise manner to make that thing go around the corners at 230 miles an hour. Wow. What a process that is. But it was Bill, the H2QGZ, who used to set up those cameras on those race cars with radio transmitters. Video camera, which was remotely controllable. You could scan the camera. You could focus the camera. You could do all kinds of fancy things by sending signals over the RF link to that camera. Have you noticed that each one of those race cars had a device hanging out of the left side of the car and out of the right side of the car, a little bit forward of the pilot, and it was a pod which had a camera in it that could be aimed at the pilot. So what a guy does when he's steering a Indy car, and what a pilot does when he's steering a Blue Angels airplane, there's a degree of similarities there. I wonder if you saw that show today, Dave, N2ABG, K2LIW.
No, I did not see that. And also I'm wondering, I think John is on frequency, WGB. I had given him the frequencies, and he said he was going to try to listen. I wonder if he had any success hearing them, because he is obviously much further away from the planes than I was. I was within, most of the time they were about, from where I was, they were about 3 miles away, which, you know, again, they're up in the air and I'm on the ground, so it should, you know, the signal should be pretty strong, and I thought it was relatively weak. So I wonder if John was able to hear them in Staten Island.
John, did you hear anything?
No, Dick, I wasn't able to listen. I had other issues I had to deal with. I had a little problem there, so... and I'll tell you about it later. Thank you.
Yeah, once you get a hold of a good signal generator that can go to 230, 270, 280 megahertz, that's a calibrated signal generator, it would be very entertaining to measure the sensitivity of your scanner receiver. I'm listening to you guys right now with an ICR-7000. I'm transmitting with a Kenwood 711, but I'm listening to what's coming back. I do full duplex that way with the ICR-7000. ICR-7000 is a pretty nice receiver if it hasn't been bombed with lightning or strong signals or whatever. It's got a very delicate front-end transistor that, according to Hal, rather frequently gets blown, and mine is blown. Arguably one of the strongest ham radio transmitters on Long Island is Limark. I'm guessing they, on a good day, run 75 watts output, station master antenna, mounted 330 feet above the ground, on ground that's 300 feet above sea level, direct line of sight between me and it. In order for my receiver to hear a snow freeze signal from Limark in my R7000, I have to turn on a 20 dB preamp in front of it. One of these days when I get a chance to check it out, let me drop it. One of these days I've got to check out my ICR-7000, measure its sensitivity. It should be a quarter of a microvolt, and I'll bet you it's 10 microvolts, if you know what I mean. That would be 20 dB down, so to speak. And that's why I've got to run a preamp. Without the preamp, I hear a very snowy signal from Limark. So I've got to fix mine. And so there's a slim chance that either your broadband antenna wasn't too good an impedance match at those 230 megacycle frequencies, and or there is a slim possibility that your scanner receiver doesn't have quite the sensitivity you would like it to have, for whatever reason, design or damage. Until you measure it with a signal strength, with a calibrated signal generator, you wouldn't know. Now back to you, Dave. N2APG, K2LIW.
Comment WS2N to Dave.
Dave, you take it first, then give it to Paul.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul. Let's see what he has to say. Yeah, Dave, I don't know what your QTH is, but on Thursday night, they have a Connecticut net. It's a simplex net. And these guys know everything there is to know about scanners. You talk about scanners, they know about scanners. They know about these airplanes, power output. They know about the helicopters, the rescue helicopters, the jets, the Blue Angels. You know, they can give you any kind of information that, you know, if you're really serious about looking it up. They're on Thursday night. You point your antenna to Milford, Connecticut. And every Thursday night on, for, you know, they've been there for years. At 8 o'clock on 145.505, 145.505. And a bunch of guys that know this type of thing. But there's one guy in particular, Bob N1ML, that just a wealth of information. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I was listening to the input, not the output. Somebody just said something. So it doesn't sound like you. I don't think you have measured the sensitivity. calling sensitivity. We're about to find out how well yours is doing, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah, that would be a good experiment, absolutely. I have a friend that has some equipment that we could measure that on, so that's also a possibility. But I don't know. I just, I got the impression the signals were just on the weak side, so I'm not sure. More to follow. It would be interesting to see what kind of transmitters they run, too. I don't know, what's in these military planes, whether it's, a 5-watt transmitter or 50-watt transmitter. On those frequencies, so I don't know. But again, it was good. The air show was good. Always great to see them. And what I like to do is one day go to the actual beach to the air show to see them fly overhead, and then another day go to the airport where they're based out of. In this case, it was Republic in Farmingdale, and you watch them take off and land, and do their routine from start to finish, which incidentally is perfectly timed and choreographed from beginning to end. Every second is absolutely choreographed, and it's something to see. If you haven't seen it, highly recommended.
I'm in. So you took a whole bunch of pictures and you mailed them to John and me and Wes. Who's the person with comment? Go right ahead. Give us your call letters and name, sir.
Good evening, all. Name is Hank, call is N1YDY, and the comment was, how powerful are aircraft, military aircraft AM radios, and they are 25 watts nominally.
Good to know, Hank. I was going to guess more than 10, but less than 50, because air-to-ground and air-to-air, line of sight, it takes an amazingly small amount of power. When you're line of sight, for instance, with the space shuttle at probably 160 miles altitude, when it was over northern Texas, 1,500 miles from me, and astronaut Owen Garriott was running a Motorola handy talkie at 5 watts into the rubber duck and into the mag-mount whip antenna, 5/8 wave whip antenna on the top of my car in the parking lot of AIL in Deer Park. He was a healthy 10 dB, 15 dB signal-to-noise ratio, carrier-to-noise ratio, from 1,500 miles running 5 watts. So when you've got line of sight, it doesn't take a whole lot of power. Over to you, Dave, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Hank, for that that info. Good stuff. And there's a wealth of information online. And the more you investigate something, that you just get all sorts of neat information. And incidentally, there was you go on YouTube and you do a search for Blue Angels, and there's a tremendous amount of stuff on YouTube. People obviously are taking videos at the airport, at the air show, and all that other stuff. But I also stumbled upon, I guess, some sort of documentary, like a TV production. It was probably about 50 minutes long, and it was about the Blue Angels, about the planes, and about the pilots, and it was kind of a behind-the-scenes look at their operation, and, the cameras were rolling when they were, in their little meetings and things like that. It was very, very well done, very informative, and it was great to see.
I've got a further question for you, Dave, but let me ask Hank first. Hank, N1YDY. Where Dave said that they were listening, he has reason to believe they were using three simultaneous frequencies. Do you believe it's possible that many of the aircraft of the Blue Angels were listening to each of those frequencies at the same time and the audio being mixed together? Is that a possibility from what you know about those aircraft transceivers, Hank? N1YDY, K2LAW. Okay, maybe Hank had called away. And, I think I heard you earlier. By the way, when it comes to the G-suit answer, I can't take credit for that, Dave. I heard you earlier say that to John. Also, I think you were telling John that the Blue Angels fly with, I believe it's 6 aircraft, but I think there's a total of 7 or 8 aircraft right at the Republic Airport. 1 or 2 of those aircraft are spares, just in case one of the aircraft is not